We're in the beginning of stages of walking through the book of Joshua, and the book of Joshua is, guess who the book of Joshua is about? Joshua. It's mostly about God, right? But Joshua is a big character in there. So Joshua chapter 4, we're going to read that in a second. It's going to be on the wall. I want to show you a picture, though. This is a picture of a teapot. And I want to tell you the story behind that teapot. In 1954, my father was 4 years old, and he went with his parents, my grandparents. My grandfather was between jobs a little bit, and so they stayed the summer in a little house in the mountains of Central Oregon. The little house was my great grandfather's and my great grandmother's home. They lived there in logging country. And the house wasn't originally a house, it was originally a garage that a logging mill owned, but it was converted into a little bit of a house so people could live there. My great-grandfather lived there for a few years because it was free. He worked for the mill owned it, and so it was free, so he lived there. It had a kitchen, it had a large room, and that was pretty much the downstairs, a kitchen and a large room. It had some space upstairs where people could sleep. There was no running water. There was no electricity. There was no sewer. There was a outhouse detached from the house. Apparently, it was a little scary to my four-year-old dad at the time. The water they got was channeled in from a stream nearby, and they had one of those mossy wooden channels that they kind of diverted the water to a little pond, and they would pull out of that pond and boil it for cooking and boil it for heated up for baths. The house had apparently a big porch on the front. Didn't have an overhang, but it had a porch that was built on the front. And my dad, he only was there maybe for 4 or 5 months that summer before their family moved to Northern California to a different area to log. But he tells stories about how the ladies would gather and they would shuck corn on the porch. Throw it out. They didn't have trash pickup, so they'd throw it out, and the deer would come and eat it. I don't know what you call. I don't think you shuck green beans. You do something to green beans to get snap. Thank you. So they snapped the green beans and threw that out so that the deer could get it, and they'd can those green beans. And there was like all of this buzz and activity on the porch. The deer that would come and eat the scraps would mysteriously. A few of them would disappear in the fall, and then mysteriously they would be having venison sometimes at night. In the evening, without electricity, without TV and other things, apparently Fridays and Saturdays, the people in other homesteads around the area would come, and they'd bring dishes, and they'd have a meal, and they'd crank the record player and listen to the music and talk politics and just about life. Those are some of my dad's fondest memories. He talks about them. He kind of lights up a little bit. My great-grandfather, great-grandpa Seeger, we used to call him. I remember him vaguely. He worked at the mill. It was his home that they were staying in. He worked at the mill, and he was what they call a pond man. He was the pond man. And so what that was is he would sit in a boat or stand in a boat in the mill pond with a big fork, and he would direct the logs. When they came in, he would direct the logs to where they needed to go. My dad said that at one day, my great-grandfather took him to the pond, to the mill, and took him on the boat, showed him what he did in 1954 that summer. My great-grandfather, when he would finish work, he would get in his late 30s blue Chrysler, and he would drive up the hill on a dirt road to get to the house. And when he got to the house, he would pull in this circular dirt driveway that had wild strawberries in the middle of it, and he'd park his Chrysler, and when it had cooled down, every day he would take a teapot, and he would refill his radiator, because apparently, for whatever reason, the radiator had less water at the end of the day than it did at the beginning of the day, so to make it back to the mill, he needed to put water in it. So he'd put water in it with a teapot, and he'd put a teapot on a stump there by that circular dirt driveway. When I was 4, I went with my father, who was who was older than four at that point, and my grandparents, my great-grandparents were dead at that point, but my grandparents went with us, and we went up to the old homestead to see what was still there. And it had been sold. I have a picture in my mind. I was young, but I have a picture in my mind of the area, just overgrown woods. The land had been sold, and they had turned into a gravel pit. So they had torn down the house. They had pulled out a lot of the gravel from the area. So the only thing that was left really was trees and you know, overgrowth of the woods. The one thing that we found was this teapot. And it was sitting on the stump that my great-grandfather would put it after he had filled up his radiator. So this teapot is about all we have of those memories. It sits in my parents' yard. I actually had them take a picture of it and email it to me this week. That's about all we have of the memories of what happened there in the mountains of Central Oregon back in the 50s and earlier. But in some ways, it's kind of a memorial. It reminds us of the stories and the summer my dad spent there. This morning, we're going to look at Joshua 4. And Joshua 4 happens in a different time, in a different place. And there's not a teapot, but there's a pile of stones that Joshua 4 talks about. And like the teapot, the pile of stones was set up, God said, to set those up as a memorial, as a reminder of what had happened there, not in the woods, but at the shore of a river, the Jordan River. So let's read Joshua 4, Joshua chapter 4. When all the nations had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, 'Take 12 stones from here out of the midst, out of the middle of the Jordan, from the very place where the priests' feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight.' Then Joshua called the 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, 'Pass on before the ark of the Lord your God, into the midst, into the middle of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of tribes of the people of Israel, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask you in times to come, 'What do these stones mean to you?' then you shall tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever." And the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of the tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the place where they lodged and laid them down there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood. And they are there to this day. For the priest bearing the Ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. The people passed over in haste. I love that little detail. I'm thinking if I was part of the group and the river all of a sudden stopped flowing and I was told to go across, I would hurry. I would hurry. They hurried. And when all the people had finished passing over, the ark of the Lord and the priest passed over before the people. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh, all tribes of Israel, they passed over armed before the people of Israel as Moses had told them. About 40,000 ready for war passed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they stood in awe of him just as they had stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Command priests bearing the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan." So Joshua commanded the priests, "Come up out of the Jordan." And when the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priest's feet were lifted up on the dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. The people came up out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they encamped at Gilgal at the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, "When your children ask their fathers in times to come, 'What do these stones mean?' then you shall let your children know, 'Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan. He dried them up for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over.'" He dried them up so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. As soon as the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. So, 4 is a continuation of chapter 3, and in these chapters, God stops the river for the people to go across, but there's a bigger purpose than this, just for them to cross. The bigger purpose in these verses, it says a few times, is God did that to make himself known. He did that to make himself known to the Israelites, and then to, did you hear that in the last verse? To the nations. That they would hear what he did, and that they would know who he was, that he was strong. In chapter 4, there is this focus, twice, there's this focus on the stones. It's as if God is looking ahead, and he's saying, listen, your next generation, the generations later, and even you, in a few months and few years, are going to need to remember what I did. You're going to need to remember this so that you will know who I am. And so he told him to build this rock memorial. Now I started, as I was thinking through this, I started to think, what would a conversation have sounded like between, think about a generation later or two generations later. What would a conversation have sounded like between a father and his son? A son who hadn't ever seen the water stop. Maybe even a father who had never seen the water stop, but who had heard the story. What would that conversation have sounded like? So it's a little different than what we usually do, but I want to read to you what a conversation might have sounded like just a few decades later after the Jordan stopped. I remember the first time I saw it. I was a young boy at the time. And our family lived on the west side of the Jordan, near the old ruins of Jericho. When I was 7 years old, my father took me on my first trip across the river to visit family friends. Our home was about 5 miles from the Jordan, and it took us most of the first day to reach the river. It was summer, and the river wasn't as high as it is in the spring when it floods. So our plan was to wade across, but I knew I was probably going to have to ride on my father's shoulders. As we got close, I saw it for the first time. It was a pile of stones there on the shore of the river that looked like they had been stacked years ago. I pointed to the stones and asked my father, "Dad, why are those stones piled up there? What do they mean?" Almost as if he expected me to ask, my dad said, "Son, those stones help us remember what God has done. They're a memorial." As we got closer, I noticed the stones looked different than the other stones we saw along the way, the stones along the path. I asked, "Why are those stones that are stacked, why are those smooth, Dad, when the rest of these stones on the path are rough?" These stones are from the river, son. I looked around and I saw a few stones on the edge of the river, but none of them looked like the ones in the pile. So I asked, where did they get them from? I don't see any stones like those, Dad. They came from the middle of the river. Those stones are from the middle of the river. That's why they're smooth. That didn't make any sense to me. It was summer and the river was high, or wasn't high, but it still looked impossible to me to reach down and get those big stones up while the river was flowing and then walk out of the river. I asked, how did they get them out of the middle of the river? My dad answered, almost as if he was enjoying answering my questions now. Years ago, he said, when your grandfather was a young man, the river stopped. It stopped flowing for a day, and men took those stones from the middle of the dry riverbed. That really didn't make any sense to me. So I asked, how did the river stop flowing? I didn't know that could happen. God stopped the river, son. I was quiet. How did God stop the river? I was trying to imagine the riverbed with no river in it. I was trying to picture men carrying those heavy stones to shore. And as I was lost in my thoughts, my dad pointed to a spot in the middle of the river and he said, look out there. Do you see that pile of stones underwater in the middle of the river? I hadn't seen them, and it took me a few seconds, but I eventually saw the pile of stones in the river, just like the ones on the shore. When I was your age, my dad said, your grandpa told me the story. The priests were carrying God's box that Moses made a long time ago. God told the priests to walk into the river, and when they did, God stopped the river, and it heaped up way upstream. Your grandpa and all your people crossed to the sides, to this side of the river where we live now. I've never seen anything like that, Dad. How could God do that? Son, the man who stacked these stones called our God the living God. Even though we don't see God with our eyes, he's there. He's alive. Even though we don't always see amazing things like rivers stopping, he's still there. He has done amazing things, son. And these rocks are here to help us remember that. He will do more amazing things, son. And these rocks are here to help us remember that too. Dad, I asked, is he only our God? What about the other people, the nations around us? Is he their God too? He's not just our God, son. The man who stacked these stones called God the God of all the earth. He is the God of every nation, even if they don't believe in him. He was the God of those who lived in Jericho before it was destroyed. They had sinned against God and God punished them. But Dad, they probably didn't know about God. How could they believe in God if they didn't even know about him? They did know God, son. The people in Jericho had heard about God parting the Red Sea and rescuing your great-grandfather and his people from Egypt. Your young friend Boaz, his mother Rahab lived in Jericho. She heard what God had done, and she trusted God, and God rescued her. But most of the people in Jericho didn't trust God. They heard about God stopping this river, and they knew that only a strong God could do that, but they fought God instead of trusting God. It was a lot to take in, God stopping a river, God punishing a city, God rescuing my friend's mother, Rahab. We stopped to sit and rest at the shore before crossing over. My dad unwrapped the bread he had brought for the trip. He handed me a piece and we ate and looked out over the pile of stones toward the river. I noticed a smooth stone on the ground next to the others that were stacked. It looked like it had fallen off. I guess it had been a while since it had been built. I compared it to the other stones and started to count the stones. When I got to 12, I ran out of stones to count. And I asked my dad, "Dad, why are there 12 stones? Why not 10? Why not 13? My dad answered, "One man from each of our people's tribes carried a stone from the river. The 12 stones remind us that all 12 tribes crossed over when God stopped the river. If everyone crossed the river, why do our friends live on the other side?" I asked. "Well, God told us to go over together until we took over the land." Even though there were 12 different tribes back then, it was as if there was only one tribe. They believed God was with them, and they obeyed God as one big group. "It's not like that now, is it, Dad?" "No, it's not, son. Most of our people have abandoned God. I think our people need to come out and visit these stones more often." We'd finished our bread and were standing now and putting our sandals and outer coats in our shoulder bags, and we're getting ready to wade across the river. "Dad," I asked, "who was the man that built these rock piles?" "Joshua, son." "Was he the judge when Grandpa was young?" "He was," my dad said as he looked at the stone pile again. "Joshua trusted God. He said what God told him to say. God would speak to Joshua, and Joshua would speak to the people, and the people would obey. Joshua did what God told him to do. He led our people through the river and into the land we have now." Our people knew that God was with Joshua. They were in awe of him, and they followed him, and they followed God. "I wish we had a leader like Joshua nowadays," I said. And my father answered, "So do I, son. So do I." "Do you think we'll ever have another leader like Joshua?" "I think we will," my dad said. "God told Adam that a man would be born who would defeat Satan. God told Abraham that one would be born who would be a blessing to every nation. One day another Joshua will come." "When, Dad?" I asked as we looked at the river. "I don't know, son. But these stones are a reminder to us of what God has done. They remind us that he is strong and that we can trust him." My dad looked at me in the eye and he said, "You can trust the God who stopped the river, son." My dad turned and he walked over to the stone pile. I watched as he picked up the smooth stone that had fallen on the ground. And he lifted it up, he put it back in place on top of the others. He pulled off some sticks and leaves that had been blown by the wind and caught between the rocks. When he had finished, he walked to the edge of the Jordan and he put me on his shoulders and we waded across in water that was almost over my dad's head. As we passed the stones in the middle of the river, I looked down and I wondered if they would still be there when I took my son to the river for the first time. I wondered if God would ever stop a river again. And I wondered when God would give us another leader like Joshua. The stones that were at the edge of the Jordan, those aren't there anymore. Those aren't it. Those aren't the stones. I looked it up on the internet just to double check to see if somebody had found them, if the stones on the outside of the river or inside of the river were still there, and they're not. But we still have this story in the Bible. So while we don't have the stone memorial, we do have the written memorial. In fact, when he says that these stones will be a memorial forever, we might wonder, well, but they're not there. But they are. Because they're written down, and we hear about them. And what this story reminds us of is it reminds us what God has done. And here, see, these aren't just Sunday school stories. See, the river Jordan really did stop. It really did. It really did stop way upstream. And they really did walk, not on muddy ground, and I don't get it, I don't understand, but it says they walked across on dry ground. That really happened. And the story reminds us what God has done, but here's the thing, what's even more important about reminding us what God has done is it reminds us who the God is who did it. That the God who stopped the Jordan is strong, and you can trust him. You can trust him. Who would want to trust a God who's not strong? Who would want to trust a weak God? But he's a strong God. He's a mighty God. And this story tells us of that. And it's a story that you need to tell to your sons, that you need to tell to your daughters, that you need to tell to the next generation. Because what happens is the stones fall over and the stories sit on the shelf. And the next generation doesn't know the stories. And so because they don't know the stories, they don't know what God has done. And because they don't know what God has done, they don't know who God is. And because they don't know who God is, they don't trust God. And the same thing happens that happened with the Israelites, that the next generation abandons God because they don't know and they don't remember. So we need to tell the story to the next generation. As we're, Deuteronomy 6, it talks about as you're walking by the way, as you're laying down to sleep, as you're getting up, as you're sitting down to eat, to talk about these stories. But there's a bigger story in the Bible. There's a bigger story in the Bible. In fact, there's a story in the Bible that all the other stories point to, that every story in the Bible points to. And there's a bigger hero in the Bible than Joshua, that all the other heroes, and actually all the other villains in the Bible, point to this one hero. And like Joshua, this great hero was one who did what God told him to do. And he was one that he would say what God told him to say. See, we face this flood of guilt in our lives. And I'm not talking about a feeling. I'm talking about real guilt. We are guilty that we have sinned. And we have rebelled against God, and that flood is over our heads. There's no way we can get through it. There's no way we can get around it. There's no way we can go under it. There's no way we can get over it. But what happened was this great hero, Jesus, he went right through it for us. He went right through it for us. See, Jesus doesn't just lead us across. Jesus went to a cross. He went to a cross so that the impossible could happen, that I could be cleared, that my record could be wiped, so that if I trust in him, that I can be forgiven, and that the flood is no longer over my head, but I can walk across on dry ground and be forgiven. But it's a story that sometimes is hard to remember. Sometimes it's hard for us to remember. You know, when we go to work or we go back to our neighborhoods, or we go back to our homes today. Sometimes we don't operate out of the story. We kind of forget. We don't see the connections. And what happens is, what God says is that without faith, it's impossible to please him. See, if you don't trust God, it is impossible for you to please him. Impossible. And so, what the Bible says is if we don't trust God, one of the problems is we may not remember, we may not know, we may not be remembering what he has done, who he is, that he is strong. And I love this phrase in Joshua that it says that he, and towards the end, it says that he parted the Jordan, or he stopped the Jordan for the people of Israel. He did that for them. See, the story of Jesus dying for our sin, it's a true story, and rising again, the songs that we sang this morning. See, that story tells us that he is strong and that you can trust him. And that story tells us that he cares, that he loves, and he did that for you. He did that for you, and you can trust him. See, the way that we build our faith is not by trying harder. The way that we build our faith is by remembering what he's done and trusting harder. And these stories are here to help us remember that. Now, Jesus and the Father have given us a lot of ways to remember what he has done. We have the Bible. One of one of the ways that he has given us to remember what he has done is a memorial. And it's not a teapot, and it's not a stone pile. But one of the things that Jesus did before he left was he gave us a table. He gave us a table so that every time we come to the table, the Lord's Supper table, he said to do it and remember him, to remember what he has done. That every time you see the rock pile, remember what he's done. Every time you see the table, every time you share in the Lord's Supper, remember what he's done, that he died for our sin, he rose again, and he's coming back. And remember that. Remember that he is strong. Remember that he cares. Remember that he loves you. And so the table is that. He said the night before that Jesus was killed, he was at the table with his disciples, and he said, in the future when you do this, when you take the cup and you take the bread, do it in remembrance of me. That's what he said. Do it in remembrance of me. It's not magic. It won't change you through the bread and the cup, but what will change you is when you remember who he is and you trust in him. That changes you. And we need to be reminded of that so often. And one of the ways is when we come to the table. So I'm going to ask the servers to come forward, and we're going to remember this morning together. When I was a boy, and I would go to church services like this, and before I understood, before I trusted Christ, before I followed him, they would do this. The church where I went to would do this. They would do the Lord's Supper, and then so they pass the tray, and you take a piece of bread, and I'd see the adults take a cup, and I'd be thinking, what does that mean? What does that mean? I don't remember having a specific conversation with my dad, but somebody, I'm guessing somebody explained it to me. Listen, children, if you're asking those questions, what does this mean? In fact, middle-aged people, senior citizens, if you're wondering what this means when we do this is Jesus said, he took that cup and he said, well, he took the bread first and he said, this is my body. This represents my body. And my body was broken for you. I went to a cross for you. I was flooded. I was overwhelmed by the waters of your guilt for you. And so when you eat this bread, remember what I have done for you. He took the cup and he said, this cup is, it's a symbol, just like the rocks. It's a symbol of what I will. And now on this side of the cross, we remember what he did do for us, that his blood was, he bled out for us. He died so that we could live. That's what this means. It's a memorial service, not a sad one, a sober one, but one that he said, when he did this, he said, do this in remembrance of me. He said, until I come back, do this in remembrance. So we look back and we remember what he did, but we also look forward and we remember what he's going to do, because the best is yet to come, and we remember that too. So the bread and the cup, the servers will bring those by, and if you've trusted in Christ, if you are following him, we invite you to take that bread and that cup. And if you're here and you're asking questions like, what does this mean, we're so thankful you're here, and we invite you to remember with us as we take this. And when you take that bread and that cup, wait until all of us are served, and then we'll share in that together. So this is what it says happened. And when Jesus had given thanks, he broke the bread and he said, "This is my body. Take, do this in remembrance of me." And in that same time, in the same way, he took the cup and he said, "This is the cup of my new promise that I seal with my blood. Do this in remembrance of me."